Donald Trump said he would let RFK Jr. go wild on federal health policy, and now the president-elect is nominating his formal rival to lead the Department of Health and Human Services. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. What does a Republican foreign policy expert make of President Trump's cabinet picks? I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. We'll ask John Bolton, who served as a top advisor to Trump and George W. Bush. Plus, why bond market investors are alarmed about President Trump's economic agenda. And on this week's StoryCorps, we meet a nurse injured in a bombing on a clinic in Alabama that performed abortions. It is Friday, November 15th. Happy birthday to famed shoe designer Jimmy Choo. He is 76 years old today. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. President-elect Donald Trump has nominated Robert F. Kennedy Jr. to lead the Department of Health and Human Services. As NPR's Stephen Fowler reports, Kennedy is a vaccine skeptic who has espoused conspiracy theories about health care.
In the announcement on his Truth Social platform, Trump says that public health has seen, quote, deception, misinformation, and disinformation from drug and food companies. In recent years, Kennedy himself has shared conspiracy theories about health, falsely claiming Wi-Fi causes cancer and that chemicals in water can make children transgender. If confirmed by the Senate, Kennedy would oversee nearly $2 trillion in mandatory spending. HHS also oversees the CDC, the FDA, and the National Institutes of Health. Stephen Fowler, NPR News, Atlanta.
President-elect Trump also says he will nominate former Georgia Congressman Doug Collins to lead the Department of Veterans Affairs. Trump is also going to select North Dakota Governor Doug Burgum as Secretary of the Interior Department. President Biden is in Peru today, where he will meet several world leaders, including those from South Korea and Japan. As NPR's Asma Khalid reports, Biden is trying to cement this trilateral relationship as he wraps up his presidency and prepares other nations for the incoming Trump administration.
This three-way cooperation on technology and security has been a hallmark of the Biden administration, and it's a relationship they hope the Trump team will embrace. Here's Biden's national security advisor, Jake Sullivan, speaking to reporters on Air Force One.
And given the bipartisan support for it, we fully expect that it would continue under the next administration, though, of course, they'll make their own decisions.
This relationship is part of Biden's broader strategy of working with allies in the region to counter China's influence. And this meeting with South Korea and Japan comes a day ahead of a separate meeting that Biden is holding tomorrow with his Chinese counterpart, Xi Jinping. Asma Khalid, NPR News, Lima.
New York Governor Kathy Hochul is advancing a plan to impose a fee on motorists who drive into the busiest parts of New York City. Hochul suspended the congestion pricing program in June, shortly before it was to start. From member station WNYC, Stephen Nesson has more.
Governor Hochul paused the original plan, saying with inflation and the high cost of living, a $15 daily toll was too high. Now, she wants to relaunch it and charge vehicles that drive in Manhattan, south of 60th Street, $9 a day.
Of course I understand how hard this is, but this is the law of the state of New York. I'm obligated to follow New York law. And I worked hard to find a creative solution to relieve the burden on these same individuals who are struggling.
President-elect Donald Trump has promised to kill the tolls once in office. In a statement, he says he respects the governor but disagrees with the decision. The tolls are expected to launch on January 5th. For NPR News, I'm Stephen Nesson in New York.
This is NPR. Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell says the nation's central bank is not in a hurry to cut interest rates. Speaking in Dallas, Powell says while inflation isn't at the Fed's 2% target, the U.S. economy is strong. A federal investigation has found that Georgia's Fulton County Jail in Atlanta violates the civil rights of people in its custody. The report says this is through failing to protect people from violence, using excessive force, and holding them in unsafe and filthy conditions. From member station WABE in Atlanta, Shemaine Cruz has more.
The Justice Department launched a civil rights investigation nearly a year after a black man with serious mental health needs died at the Fulton County Jail. Others have died or been assaulted and stabbed. Kristen Clark is an assistant attorney general for the department's civil rights division. She says investigators later found crumbling infrastructure and that jail staff were impeding inmates' access to medical and mental health care and punishing them with long stints in isolation.
We are hoping to turn the page today.
The federal report outlines a number of reforms needed, but Clark says no legal action is expected for those responsible for the jail's conditions. For NPR News, I'm Shemaine Cruz in Atlanta.
Florida is suing FEMA Administrator Deanne Criswell and a former FEMA worker. State officials allege the worker told staff to skip Florida homes with hurricane damage if they had Trump signs. Criswell has apologized and the worker has been fired. Florida's attorney general is alleging FEMA engages in political discrimination. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the John Templeton Foundation, funding interdisciplinary research and catalyzing conversations to inspire awe and wonder. Learn more at templeton.org. And the listeners who support this NPR station.
Welcome to MN90, Minnesota history in 90 seconds.
Do it, baby! Do it!
In 2004, Nirvana released a box set. Hidden among the discs were several Easter eggs, including a video of drummer Dave Grohl throwing a cymbal at icicles hanging off eaves in 1993 in Cannon Falls, Minnesota. What was the world's biggest rock group doing in Cannon Falls? Recording the follow-up to their immensely successful album, Nevermind. Grohl, Chris Novoselic, and lead singer Kurt Cobain wanted to go back to basics. They found their producer in Steve Albini, and it was Albini who suggested Pachyderm Studios in Cannon Falls.
Are we rolling?
February to March 1993, the trio holed up in the studio and recorded the tracks that would make their way onto the band's last studio album. Cobain died the next year. Though In Utero got mixed reviews on its release, many now consider it Nirvana's best.
MN90 is produced by Ampers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities. Made possible by funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Online at mn90.org.
Morning edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Coming up, what does John Bolton, a former member of President Trump's national security team, think of that team for the second term?
But first, we're going to hear about Trump's pick to run an agency that affects the health of hundreds of millions of Americans, the Department of Health and Human Services.
The environmental advocate and vaccine skeptic RFK Jr., Robert F. Kennedy Jr., has claimed that he will drastically reduce the rates of chronic disease in just 2 years. He has also, during this campaign, spread a lot of conspiracy theories, for example, that Wi-Fi causes cancer, no evidence of that, or that school shootings are linked to antidepressants.
Joining us to tell us more about Kennedy's background and what his confirmation could mean for the agency is NPR health policy correspondent Selena Simmons-Duffin. Selena, good morning.
Morning, Michelle.
So obviously many people have heard of Kennedy. He's part of a very famous Democratic political family that includes the former president, John F. Kennedy. But tell us more about him as a public figure.
Well, most recently he ran for president as an independent before dropping out in August and endorsing Trump, who's been enthusiastically using his Make America Healthy Again line. Kennedy is an attorney. He went to Harvard in the 70s and got his law degree at UVA. He struggled with drug addiction, and it was actually an arrest for heroin possession in the 80s that led to volunteering with the Natural Resources Defense Council to fulfill community service hours. That led to a whole career in environmental advocacy. And around 20 years ago, he got interested in vaccine conspiracy theories, especially in the disproven link between vaccines and autism. That has been a huge focus of his work and life since then.
Okay, so what about the agency he would be in charge of? Give us a tour of the Department of Health and Human Services.
So HHS is enormous. It's got one of the biggest budgets in the federal government, $1.7 trillion. That's trillion with a T. That's about the GDP of Australia. And within HHS are a lot of health agencies. Medicare and Medicaid are under HHS. So is the Food and Drug Administration, the National Institutes of Health, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Those are probably the health agencies people hear the most about. But there are all these other agencies, like one that runs community health centers across the country. There's another for mental health. In all, HHS employs about 90,000 people across these agencies. Trump has promised to let Kennedy, quote, go wild on health and dramatically shake things up.
Do we have any idea of what Kennedy going wild on health might look like?
Well, he recently said he'd like to fire 600 NIH employees. He's talked a lot about rooting out corruption. Some of his ideas are pretty mainstream, like promoting nutritious foods and addressing chronic disease. He said he wants to ban prescription drug advertisements. He rightly points out that American life expectancy is really pretty bad and lags behind other wealthy countries by a lot. But he has some views that are really far out of the mainstream. We've talked about vaccine skepticism. Current CDC director Mandy Cohen wrote to NPR yesterday, quote, "I don't want to go backwards and see children or adults suffer or lose their lives to remind us that vaccines work, and so I'm concerned," unquote. The idea of someone who's actively sowed misinformation about vaccines being in charge of the government's scientific research and public health agencies really horrifies a lot of people in those fields.
This is a Senate-confirmed position. Do we have a sense of whether he will have the votes to be confirmed?
Well, we'll have to see. Some Republican senators have responded enthusiastically to his nomination. Others won't say yet. Interestingly, his campaign website says he supports abortion access. He wrote, quote, "I'm for choice and medical freedom." We'll see how that position plays out among Republicans who are eager to curtail abortion access federally once they take power in Washington.
That is NPR's Selena Simmons-Duffin. Selena, thank you.
You're welcome.
We now know the president-elect's top choices for his national security team, the people who would advise the president in a crisis. Some are unsurprising, like veteran Senator Marco Rubio for Secretary of State. He has a lot of foreign policy experience. Others have raised questions in the Senate, which would normally have to confirm the nominees. For Director of National Intelligence, Trump wants the Senate to confirm Tulsi Gabbard, a former Democratic lawmaker who made news by meeting with Syria's leader and repeating Russian conspiracy theories about Ukraine, among other things. For Attorney General Matt Gaetz, a Florida provocateur who repeated a Proud Boys slogan while attending Trump's criminal trial and whose resignation from Congress seems to have ended an ethics investigation. John Bolton has questions about both. He was President Trump's national security advisor for part of his first term and later wrote a memoir critical of the president. He's on the line. Ambassador, welcome back.
Glad to be with you. Thanks for having me.
What concerns you about Matt Gaetz and Tulsi Gabbard?
Well, I think they are in a category by themselves in terms of the Trump nomination so far in the national security field. Neither one of them has the competence or the character or the moral fitness to hold those positions. And what's going to be interesting here is I think there's so much about them we don't yet know, and the more that comes out, the more difficult they're confirmation process will be. And really, they're like, each of them are like hand grenades waiting to go off.
Can I just ask, I understand what you're saying about Matt Gaetz, because there's this ethics investigation, and there are Republican senators who want to look at the findings of the ethics investigation. But you raised the question of character, and you included former Congresswoman Gabbard, who might say, look, I'm a veteran, I've served my country, I've served Congress, I just have ideas you don't agree with. What's wrong with her character?
Well, consorting with the enemies of the United States, like Bashar al-Assad, the leader of Syria, as she's done, I think is a character question. And I think her spouting Russian propaganda over the years is a character question. Mitt Romney once called comments she made about Putin's aggression against Ukraine treasonous. Now, she makes these comments and backs away from them, but I don't think that's a question of disagreement over issues. I think that's a fundamental question about her loyalty. And given that her job, if she's confirmed, is keeper of the secrets of the United States, that's incredibly serious. And that's why I think Republicans who are rushing to throw themselves over these grenades for Donald Trump really need to hold back until they hear more about both of these nominees, because the senators are risking their personal integrity and really their place in history by kind of blindly saying that they'll support them.
Would you explain for people who may not know what role Matt Gaetz as Attorney General would play, not just in law enforcement, but in national security situations, in various urgent situations?
Well, the Attorney General is a member of the National Security Council. The Justice Department is a major player in national security affairs. The FBI has a critical role in uncovering spies in the United States and plots against American citizens, like the ongoing Iranian effort to kill a number of current and former U.S. government employees. It has a counterintelligence function that's critical. The Justice Department's National Security Division prosecutes national security-related crimes. And frequently, the Attorney General will see crimes being committed or being investigated by foreign governments, foreign officials, foreign citizens trying to influence this country. So this is obviously it's a law enforcement job, but it's got critical national security elements as well. And somebody who doesn't have the moral fitness, let alone the competence to do it, really is disqualified. There is a legitimate deference that the Senate should owe to a president and his nominees. The president should be able to get his own team, mm-hmm. except where there are manifest inadequacies in competence and character and moral fitness. The confirmation process has been, I think, changed over the years into disagreement on substance. The policy substance, I think that's where the deference to the president comes in.
I've got to ask you one more question about 20.
I don't know the deference is owed.
About 20 seconds left here. You wrote a book, Ambassador, called The Room Where It Happened, about being in the room when vital decisions are made. In about 20 seconds, what do you think about when you think of this national security team in some crisis gathering to advise this president?
I think what the president wants in national security, for sure, is a group of yes men and women. And I hope the people who go into it, and some of the nominations I certainly support, remember their personal integrity. Give the president their best judgment. Don't be yes men and yes women. That's critical for our country.
John Bolton was a top foreign policy advisor to President George W. Bush and then to President Trump. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
We knew it was good, but Texas barbecue just earned a new level of respect. This week, eateries in Austin and Houston each earned a coveted Michelin star. I don't know why I didn't get this assignment, but Wynn Davis of member station KUT did, and he's going to tell us about it.
When the Michelin Guide announced that for the first time it was expanding to Texas, it got a lot of attention. There was never a doubt that upscale restaurants featuring multi-course tasting menus would make the list. But the big question was, would barbecue, a Texas staple, make the cut?
I don't think the community could even fathom the idea that a barbecue restaurant would get a star.
That's Sawyer Lewis, co-owner of Leroy & Lewis in Austin, one of four barbecue restaurants awarded a prestigious Michelin star.
I mean, there's almost nothing left on my plate now. I got the beef cheeks, the hop sausage, the kale Caesar, and the Frito pie.
Customer Jordan Blossom is a regular here at Leroy & Lewis. Blossom says he's taken friends and family here for years. He's excited that they can say they loved this barbecue even before it won a Michelin star.
The beef cheeks and the hop sausage is like kind of what I first loved when Leroy & Lewis opened up. And these two sides are just my favorite sides. You feel like you don't have to take a nap after you have like a kale Caesar as a side for barbecue.
In Texas, there is no shortage of places to go for melt-in-your-mouth brisket, world-class ribs, and tasty sausage. So what makes these restaurants stand out?
For us, it's really important to push the food beyond that core trinity.
That's Chef John Bates of Interstellar Barbecue in Austin, another restaurant that won a Michelin star.
We like to introduce new techniques, new flavors, things like pork belly, adding sauces like chimichurri, wacky sausages. You know, we cook duck confit on Fridays. We try to expand the possibilities of Texas barbecue.
These restaurants are not going to feature white tablecloths, and eating barbecue can get messy. But that's part of the magic. As for what comes next, Lewis, Bates, and the other winning barbecue spots say they plan to stay focused on what works while continuing to push the boundaries of barbecue. For NPR News, I'm Wynn Davis in Austin.
This is NPR News.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. The road connecting the communities of northern Oahu in Hawaii passes by Punalu'u Beach, a narrow public park. But sea level rise and other threats are increasing erosion at Punalu'u Beach, putting both the park and the road at risk.
this is an area that, again, is connected by one road in, one road out. And if we lose the road there, then we'll lose that community as well.
Leah Laramie is with Hawaii's State Climate Commission. The state has been studying some long-term options for protecting Punalu'u Beach, including adding sand to the beach. But the community wanted to take immediate action, too. So in March, volunteers helped plant native plants in the beach's sand dunes. Laramie says these plants help prevent erosion by stabilizing the beach while still allowing for the slow, natural movement of sand.
We were hoping to get, you know, like 20-odd people, but we ended up getting 75 volunteers, which was just so amazing to see so many people come out and care for the space there.
Laramie says since then, residents have continued to weed and water the new plants, helping to protect their beach, road, and communities from erosion as sea levels rise. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
For NPR comes from this station and from Indiana University, committed to moving the world forward and working to tackle some of society's biggest challenges. 9 campuses, one purpose, creating tomorrow today. More at iu.edu. From Procter & Gamble, maker of Nervive. Nervive Nerve Relief is designed to reduce occasional nerve aches, weakness, and discomfort in hands or feet due to aging. Learn more at nervivehealth.com. From Fisher Investments, Fisher is committed to helping clients stay on track to reach their financial goals and enjoy a comfortable retirement. Fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. An anti-malaria drug that has saved millions of lives may be losing its effectiveness. In Africa, where many children are at risk, medical professionals are worried. NPR's Gabriella Emanuel reports on a new study in the medical journal JAMA.
Ruth Namazi is a pediatrician at Mulago Hospital in Uganda. She says a couple times a day she admits a child with severe malaria. This can mean a high fever, convulsions, anemia.
They can't stand or feed on their own. So these are very critically ill children.
Then Namazi does what she's been doing for years. She gives these patients one of the most effective malaria medications available, a drug called artemisinin.
It works like magic.
Artemisinin is derived from an ancient Chinese malaria treatment that was rediscovered several decades ago and has made a profound difference. But lately, the magic of this drug hasn't been working as well. Usually, artemisinin kills most of the parasites in the patient's blood within hours. But now, doctors are seeing patients where it takes the drug several days to work. Namazi says colleagues are stopping one another in the hospital ward with worried looks.
People are talking, you know, malaria is very stubborn, it's responding to treatment.
She wanted to understand why. So she teamed up with colleagues and launched a study. Chandi John from Indiana University School of Medicine is a co-author.
What we found was that children with severe malaria do have evidence of drug resistance.
Meaning some of the patients had a malaria parasite that had mutated to resist the medication. On top of that, researchers also found signs of resistance to a second malaria medication that kids are sent home with. About 10% of the patients that doctors thought were cured showed up sick again within a month.
So the combination is supposed to get rid of malaria, but we didn't actually completely get rid of it.
He says this is scary because kids with severe malaria are the most likely to die from the disease. And even if they survive, they often suffer long-term damage, kidney damage, brain damage. They need a drug that works fast. Kasturi Haldar is at the University of Notre Dame and has been studying malaria for decades. She was not involved in this study, but she says the findings are very concerning, but not entirely surprising.
This is quite similar to what has happened in Southeast Asia, where there has been clinical resistance to these drugs.
She says the answer might be adding another malaria medication to the standard treatment. Or finding a new drug.
But the development of a new drug is a very long process.
There is one thing giving doctors hope. In the past few years, malaria vaccines have become available. It's now a race against the clock to control malaria before it develops more resistance to malaria medications. Gabriela Emanuel, NPR News.
It's Friday, which means it's time for StoryCorps. On a January morning in 1998, a terrorist detonated a bomb at the New Woman All Women Healthcare Clinic in Birmingham, Alabama. A police officer working security, Robert Sandy Sanderson, became the first person killed in a bombing on a clinic that performs abortions in the U.S. A nurse, Emily Lyons, was severely injured. She spoke with her husband, Jeff.
I didn't know about the risk when I got the job. When I went to work the first day, I was wondering why there was protesters standing out on the street screaming at me as I was driving in. It was a rude awakening for me. So as time went by, it wasn't just a job.
How old was your youngest patient?
The youngest patient I ever had was 10 years old. As I was speaking with her, she didn't know how she was pregnant. Nobody had taught her anything. And I can remember the day a woman took my hand and she just, you know, squeezed it and said, thank you. That made you know that it was all worthwhile. But one day I went to work pretty much like any other day, and a patient and her father pointed to something over in the yard and said, what is that? And Sandy, the police officer, took out his nightstick and started to go through to the bomb. Well, the terrorist was standing across the street, so he pushed the button and watched the destruction that he did to Sandy and myself.
The police officer, Sandy, was murdered. He saved the person that is most important to me, and yet I never met him.
Sandy was very mild-mannered, courteous. He was not pro-choice. But he knew he had a job to do the days that he came to the clinic to provide security. It didn't matter to him why you were there. He was there to protect us. And yes, indeed, on that day, his body did protect me.
When I walked in to the hospital, I thought I was in the wrong room. I didn't recognize you. It was that bad. How many operations have you had so far?
As of this year, there have been 57. Every day that I get up, it's an effort to get out of bed. But scars just tell people that you were stronger than those who tried to hurt you. I don't know what happened during that bomb, but it sure flipped a switch in my brain, because not much intimidates you once you've been blown up. You know, life knocks everybody down. But what matters is how you stand up, and we have stood up together.
Emily Lyons with her husband Jeff for StoryCorps in Birmingham, Alabama. You can hear more on the StoryCorps podcast. Their conversation is archived in the Library of Congress.
Major support for StoryCorps comes from Subaru, featuring the 2024 Subaru Crosstrek Wilderness. With off-road capability and 9.3 inches of ground clearance designed for adventure seekers. Learn more at Subaru.com/wilderness. And from Dignity Memorial, helping families protect their loved ones and gain peace of mind by planning cremations and funerals in advance. Dedicated to professionalism and compassion in every detail. More at DignityMemorial.com.
This is NPR News.
During Donald Trump's first term in office, appointing federal judges became one of his biggest accomplishments.
We could be looking at a Trump judiciary for the next generation or so.
I'm Elsa Chang. How a second Trump term could cement and extend that legacy in the courts. On All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered starts at 4 o'clock this afternoon with your local host, Andrew DeZingle. Good morning. Thank you for listening to the Friday Morning Show on KAXE. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up in a few moments, our Daily Dose of Phenology with John Latimer.
Patchy fog early this morning, then becoming mostly sunny, highs in the upper 40s. Lows tonight in the mid-30s, and for tomorrow, mostly cloudy to partly sunny, highs in the upper 40s to low 50s with southeast winds 10 to 15 gusting higher. Looking ahead to Sunday, a mix of clouds and sun, slight chance for rain in the morning, and highs in the mid-40s. Bemidji Community Theater presents Scrooge, the musical adaptation of A Christmas Carol, beginning tonight. It's also tomorrow and on Sunday afternoon, next weekend as well. Tickets available at bemidjicommunitytheater.com. The Gitche Zibi Center for the Arts in Brainerd welcomes I Am, He Said. Matt V, family and friends celebrate the music of Neil Diamond. That is tonight, 7 o'clock. Tickets and more information at clcperformingarts.com. Let us know about events happening in your community. Send us an email, psa@kaxc.org. Bemidji Symphony Orchestra presents Simple Gifts this Sunday, 3 o'clock at Bemidji High School Auditorium, featuring three songs by Aaron Copeland and Walton's Viola Concerto. Tickets at bemidjisymphonyorchestra.com. Volunteers are trained and ready to interview local veterans and service members for United Way of Northeastern Minnesota's Operation Service Stories Project. Interviews will be transcribed and archived. Learn more at unitedwaynemn.org/history. Learn about canvas teepee construction with artist Rory Wakeemup at Rail River Folk School in Bemidji, November 18th through the 23rd, from noon to 4 each day. It's an open workshop for anyone who wants to learn or observe the process.
On today's date, November 15th in the year 2000, standing in my yard bathed in the light of a full moon, I hear the calls of the tundra swans. The tundra swans are seldom seen in Minnesota. Spring and fall are the only times that they come through. If you see a flock of tundra swans, that is more than 20 birds, chances are you're looking at tundra swans and not the local trumpeter swan. The tundra swans move through the area in the fall, usually at night. I have seen an occasional flock during the day, but usually at night, and there's some calling going back and forth that's a bit unusual, sort of like geese barking, but not exactly. And just that strange call catches your ear and causes you to look up. And every once in a great while, you'll actually see the flock as it moves across maybe the face of the moon, but it's unusual. They are on their way to Chesapeake Bay, where they will spend the winter. And then, again in the spring, they will come back through just as the ice is going out of area lakes. They nest far north in the Arctic Circle.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Uma, a cloud-based phone service for any size business with an automated virtual receptionist, video meetings, and other features to connect to customers and coworkers anywhere at uma.com/NPR. From Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. Stocks surged following Donald Trump's re-election, but the bond market is a different story. They've been selling off in a big way, and that affects everything from interest rates to inflation.
Yeah, bond investors say they're alarmed about parts of the president-elect's economic agenda, which is important because the bond market matters so much for business and governing. If interest rates are low, your company and your government can borrow lots of money cheap, and if interest rates climb, life gets more expensive. Fast.
For more on this, we are joined by NPR senior business editor Raphael Nam. Raphael, good morning.
Hey, Michelle.
So just briefly, give us the basics of what are bonds and why do they matter? We've said a little bit about that, but just what are they?
Good question. A lot of people don't get bonds, but it's actually pretty simple. The way it works is that the government sells bonds to investors. We're talking banks, other countries, individual people. Think of it as a loan. The government needs to borrow money to function and to afford all of its spending. These investors are the bank, and they're lending their money to Uncle Sam. Then Uncle Sam promises to pay back these investors with interest. And when bond investors get spooked, they demand more interest from the government. And that's exactly what's happening now.
So why the sell-off?
Well, there are two critical things to the economy that could get worse under a new Trump administration: inflation and the government's finances. Now, let's tackle inflation first. Although Trump has promised to lower inflation, many bond investors believe he could actually do the opposite and take tariffs. Trump is proposing a wide range of tariffs, and the U.S. imports a lot of things: clothes, toys, shoes, tech gadgets, you name it. Tariffs obviously make those things more expensive. Trump also wants to cut taxes. For example, he wants to exempt workers in restaurants and other places from paying taxes on tips. All of that could make the country's finances a lot worse. And they are already pretty bad. The budget deficit in the last fiscal year was $1.8 trillion, the third highest on record.
So you heard Steve earlier say that bonds wield a lot of power. How do bond investors wield their power?
Because they can essentially tell the government, we won't be lending you any more money. And that would put the government in a pinch. Now, if the interest the U.S. pays on its bond surges, and it can also create a lot of pain to the country's finances. And these fears in bond markets can spread to other markets like stocks. Fear is pretty contagious after all. And it has happened before around the world. About 2 years ago in the United Kingdom, bond investors revolted. It helped create a financial storm, and it took down the prime minister in a matter of weeks. There's even a term for bond investors that wield their power this way: bond vigilantes. These investors could stop buying bonds. It's effectively telling the government, like I was telling you, we're not going to lend you any more money unless you reconsider some of your policies. Now, the U.S. is obviously much bigger than the U.K., and we also don't know what Trump is actually going to do. But things could get rocky very quickly if he does all the things he's promised.
So very briefly, how would this affect regular people?
Yes, because the U.S. bond market influences all kinds of interest payments, from credit cards to auto loans to mortgages. So when there's pain in the bond market, it's not just the Trump administration that will feel the impact. It could be people like you and me.
That is NPR's Raphael Nam. Raphael, thank you.
Thank you.
Many people in prison would like the services of a chaplain. And if you're Muslim, you find that chaplains are in short supply in prison. So a new program in Maine offers classes to inmates. Ari Snyder with Maine Public reports.
In a classroom at the Maine State Prison, a recent debate over deep moral questions got a little heated.
Santa Claus is real, Easter Bunny is real, all this stuff is real. So that's lying to your kid.
Because that's that institutionalized lying, that's that cultural lying.
But then why lie at all if Muslims are not supposed to lie?
The discussion session is part of a new program called Prison-Based Interventions for Muslim Offenders, or PRIMO for short. It aims to reduce conflict and help Muslim inmates develop a healthy and productive relationship with faith. The man who asked about lying to kids, where withholding his name in accordance with the prison's victim service review policy, says he enrolled in part to try to answer some big spiritual questions.
Is Islam the only true path towards God? And do anybody else have the path? Because I don't believe it's just Islam, because God wouldn't do that, because everybody is different. So why would you create one for everything? I don't understand that.
The questions don't settle on easy answers. But he says these debates and conversations have offered him new tools to manage his emotions and diffuse conflict.
So it gives me the chance to help understand others. Like if someone says something foul to me, I can stop and be like, why did you say it? You know what I mean? Like it's not just always aggression anymore. Now it's like, if you understand that person, y'all will never have an issue.
At its core, the premise of Primo is simple.
To understand what Islam is, what Islam isn't, and how the values and practices of Islam can feed into helping incarcerated individuals make a productive sentence.
Matthew Wilkinson, a professor of religion and public life at Cardiff University in Wales, spearheads the program. The curriculum for inmates revolves around the idea of the Muslim steward, a sort of aspirational figure who approaches others with respect, thoughtfulness, and care.
The innermost core of stewardship is reflecting on life. Being able to take a step back, reflecting on one's core values, reflecting on what one's done right and what one's done wrong.
Key to Wilkinson's vision of stewardship is building healthy relationships. He says that's a critical skill in navigating the tight quarters and sometimes high tensions of prison life and in gaining a foothold in society post-release. In Maine, the population of incarcerated Muslims is relatively small, about 140 people across 8 facilities, according to Department of Corrections Commissioner Randy Liberty. But Liberty says he wants staff to be familiar with the religion.
So they have a good understanding of how important these practices are to individuals, and there'll be no misunderstanding or disrespect of their practices.
Liberty says the department is still evaluating the impact of the program, but is already looking at how to expand it to other facilities. Abdi Awad is one of 2 inmates serving as teaching assistants in the Primo program. He's also the unofficial prison imam, leading prayers and serving as a liaison between Muslim inmates and prison administration.
Responsibility for me, responsibility for my religion, and responsibility for my community. So it's almost like if I don't do it, who will?
And he hopes Primo participants can take the model of the Muslim steward to heart.
That will help you not to return to prison or even change your behavior while you're incarcerated.
Awad says during his incarceration, he's reconnected with the core Islamic principles of kindness and community service, while also pursuing secular higher education. He says he'll be leaning on both to help guide him when he's released in a few years. For NPR News, I'm Ari Snyder in Warren, Maine.
Tomorrow morning on Weekend Edition, the actor Barry Keoghan, known for many films, including his new one, Bird, talks of growing up in 13 foster homes. Listen live on the NPR app or your local station. This is NPR News.
Much for listening to KAXE KBXE. My name is Heather Johnson and I'm the membership coordinator here. If you're enjoying our music, news, phonology updates and conversations, consider supporting the station by becoming a KAXE KBXE member today. Do you have questions about membership? We offer many options for making your contribution. I would love to chat with you. Give me a call at 218-326-1234.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on Thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. From Your Part-Time Controller, the nonprofit accounting specialists, providing financial management services to support stronger nonprofits who make the world a better place. Learn more at yptc.com/NPR. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm A. Martinez. Tonight, former heavyweight boxing champion of the world, Mike Tyson, will climb back into the ring at the age of 58. He's taking on social media star Jake Paul, who's 31 years his junior. I mean, it's been a long time since Tyson's prime fighting years.
What an uppercut by Douglas, and down goes Tyson.
That was a 1990 fight against Buster Douglas and one of the biggest upsets in boxing history.
It's over. It's over.
Mike Tyson has been knocked out.
The blow-by-blow was called on HBO by Jim Lampley. He's a legendary commentator who's covered the sport for over 30 years, and we gave him a ring. So, Jim, do you consider tonight's matchup to be a real fight?
I don't consider it a, quote, real fight. It's not a classic, legitimate boxing match. On the other hand, I know of no law or regulation which prohibits a 58-year-old man from taking his past proven boxing skills into the ring against a YouTube attraction. It is an unconventional, out-of-the-crackerjack box event. You know, if it weren't for my longtime friendship with Tyson, I wouldn't pay any attention at all. So most of my perspective has to do with my interest slash concern in what takes place.
What are you worried about?
Well, he's 58 years old, and most 58-year-old men, despite their background and despite their histories, are well advised not to go into a prize fight ring and engage in fist-to-fist combat. But money talks, and because of Jake Paul's ability to generate an audience with interest from his YouTube background, Mike has an opportunity to make money. I just think that there's risk in it.
What's happened to this sport of boxing that it needs to drag out an aging former champion out of retirement to face a social media star to generate headlines?
What's happened to American society where a guy can parlay a background in reality television to somehow become, in the eyes of millions, qualified to be president of the United States, and various other distortions take place which wouldn't have taken place in the world in which we lived 20 or 25 years ago. It's everywhere. You know, there are millions and millions of people who are very interested and excited about watching this tonight.
Is boxing doomed at this point, Jim, to live in the shadow of mixed martial arts, like the Ultimate Fighting Championship?
Well, boxing has been doomed for, 120, maybe 140 years. Boxing has always been the red light district of sports, but that has never diminished people's interest in it. Is boxing doomed to constant repetitions of this kind of event? Yeah, probably so. We're probably going to see more Jake Pauls. We're probably going to see somebody else follow Tyson's path and say, okay, what the heck? So I'm 58. What does it matter? The audience still remembers me. People are interested to see what happens to me. You know, people line up to look at the effects of train wrecks. But yes, the beginning of your question, is boxing doomed? Yes, inevitably and forever.
That's Jim Lampley, former HBO boxing blow-by-blow commentator. Jim, thank you very much.
My privilege. Talk to you later.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. Our theme music was inspired by B.J. Lederman. I'm E. Martinez.
I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
Michael Goldberg, host of the weekly show Stay Human. Coming up on Sunday, December 15th, we're hosting an afternoon of live storytelling, stories of endings, and stories for the end of the year. Starting at 2 o'clock at Clocko Brewing in Grand Rapids, some of the folks who've been regulars on Stay Human, and some irregulars too, will have a brew and a story for you. And it's an open mic. Bring a story to share if the scene and the beer inspires you. With support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund, it's Stories for the End of the Year, Sunday, December 15th, starting at 2 p.m. at Clocko Brewing. Hope to see you there.
Humans come with a built-in refractometer, a device that helps you shop at a farmer's market.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Schwab. Schwab offers investors choices like full-service wealth management, self-directed investing options, and trading on thinkorswim. More at schwab.com.
I'm David Brancaccio. First, the South Korean auto giant Hyundai is preparing for the Trump administration and expects policy changes that could alter its business by elevating two Americans to key leadership posts. Here's Marketplace's Nova Safo.
Hyundai, the third largest global automaker after Toyota and Volkswagen, has promoted its North American chief, Jose Munoz, to global co-CEO, and its appointed career U.S. diplomat Sung Kim as president in charge of its global external affairs. Automakers are preparing for the likelihood of U.S. policy changes that could impact their businesses. Trump suggested wide-ranging tariffs, including on all imports from Mexico, where automakers, including Hyundai, have plants. Also, a pullback of Biden-era electric vehicle incentives could hurt companies that have invested in North American production. I'm Nova Safo for Marketplace.
Markets, what's called the Trump trade, could be off a bit this morning, judging from stock index futures at the moment. S&P futures are down 0.5%. NASDAQ futures are down 0.8%. The dollar is down from its highs post-election, although a euro still costs less than $1.06. We'll get a reading on retail sales later this morning, covering October.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by the John Templeton Foundation, funding interdisciplinary research and catalyzing conversations to inspire awe and wonder. Learn more at templeton.org.
It's our name, so part of our job is exploring how marketplaces work in all their forms. This week, I've been visiting five markets near our headquarters in Los Angeles. None are financial markets in a formal sense, but they all have something that's getting harder to find: humans setting prices face-to-face. I'm in search of pro moves, tricks of the trade. Today, the farmers market in Santa Monica, California.
There's green zebra, red brandy wine, black brandy wine, persimmon.
Not a zebra, not wine or a persimmon fruit. They're kinds of tomatoes for sale.
This is a pineapple.
Not a pineapple, a tomato.
Isn't that glorious? The interior is like so marbled with the yellow, orange, and red.
Karen Beverland knows all the moves in this market occupying city streets just in from Santa Monica Beach. All those tomato varieties came this morning on a 3.5-hour drive from Munak Ranch up in Paso Robles. Trick of the trade, buy one and bite in. Or if you have Karen's relationships, they just let her taste.
At most stands, you can sample the product. Step aside, taste it, and if you love it, then buy more, enough for the house.
75 growers are set up here on this Wednesday. Public policy and their hard work in action. By the 1970s, smaller farmers couldn't make a buck competing with big farm and big grocery. The state of California responded with a law allowing growers to kick in a percentage of sales to pay inspectors to certify the produce is safe and really from the farm. They also were exempted from labeling and packaging rules. Farmers' markets in California flourished. Here it's crates upon crates of peach, nectarine, eggplant, and a head of green so intricate it looks like undersea coral.
The texture is so Savoy, right? There's like, they're firm. They're like the Thomas's English muffins of lettuce.
This lettuce is the work of farmer Kai Takikawa, who calls his business the Garden of. He has a reputation for getting up every hour of the night to keep things watered just right. Now we'll get back to the importance of names of sellers in a market in just a moment.
So if you want to keep your food dollars in your area, then farmers market is the best way to do that.
Karen is a pro shopper, vice president of local and specialty for Fresh Point Southern California, who's paid to forage for restaurants and to highlight unexpected fruit and veg treasures. For people like Nick Picciotto, chef de cuisine at a Taiwanese restaurant in downtown L.A. called Cato.
I get here at 7, 6:45 every Wednesday. And if there's anything on a table that I haven't seen yet or is new coming into season, I usually go over it, taste, and buy as much as I can before everyone else gets here.
And so you may not even have the recipe in mind yet, but you've spotted something that seems interesting and
this
would be good.
This is going to taste good. I want to use it. We'll figure it out.
Next trick, get to know your own taste buds.
If you prefer a Fuji apple to a Pink Lady, you like low-acid fruit. So when you go to a peach farmer, you should say, what are your low-acid varieties? If you love Pink Ladies like I love Pink Ladies, then when you walk up to a peach farmer or an apple farmer, where are your high acid varieties?
She's got what's called a refractometer, a battery-powered gizmo for a numerical readout on this.
The Fuji was 16.3.
But you never leave home without a version. It's called your tongue. And some farmers here make choosing especially easy.
My name is Michael Cerrone, and I go by Cerrone Farms, and we are from Sea Canyon, which is south of San Luis Obispo.
So if a newbie showed up here and saw this amazing produce that you have, what's a tip for the shopper?
Either they like sweet apples or they like tart. So here's my tip. We line our table up from sweet to tart. So we just point, go that way if you want tart, come this way.
There are lots of tools on Karen's market cart, a folding knife for slicing off bits for tasting, a paper towel for the schmutz. But the big tool at all the markets we've been visiting is to build relationships.
Morning, Don. This is Victor. This is Sherry. This is Troy Regeer. This is Justin and Savannah. So this is the Garden of.
A stand isn't a stand. It's a business that probably has a name, and the people working there, maybe the farmer, they have names. Jack sold me those great tomatoes a couple weeks ago. Let me see what Jack's got today.
Absolutely. Every farm stand here, they are so welcoming to anyone walking up.
Karen Beverlin is working on a book about farmers market navigation. It's due in 2026. I've been looking at tricks of the trade, how markets work in all their variety. We'll soon have a special podcast episode streamable with all five from this week, the flea, the flower, the finery, the fish, and the farmers markets. A 25-minute rest from the post-election news, whatever your politics. I'm David Brancaccio, Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.
It's a minute before 6 o'clock. Thank you for listening to the Friday Morning Show on 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXC Bagley, Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. We're telling the stories of Northern Minnesota through music, news, conversation, and events. Find more at KAXE.org. I'm Jennifer Barr. Stay tuned for more from Morning Edition and the Friday Morning Show with Heidi Holton and John Bauer. 1 hour from now, the Up North Report, local news from our region. Support comes from the Minnesota Historical Society, presenting holiday sleigh rides at the Forest History Center in Grand Rapids, featuring a horse-drawn sleigh ride through the North Woods to make holiday memories in the great outdoors. Private group reservations available upon request. More information at mnhs.info/forestholiday. Weather for today, patchy fog before 10 a.m., then mostly sunny, highs in the upper 40s. A mix of clouds and sun tomorrow, highs in the upper 40s to low 50s.
Good morning. How did